Good afternoon. You are listening to Faith and Reason on Holy Family Radio, Grand Rapids, Kalamazoo. This is your host, Dr. John Pinheiro. We hope on this program to connect the riches of the Catholic intellectual tradition to the daily lives of Catholics. Today, I'm in the studio here in Grand Rapids with somebody I work with at Aquinas College, Father Stan Drungowski, our Dominican chaplain. Welcome to the program, Father Stan.
Thank you very much, John.
Father Stan and I have talked a lot about the topic we're going to cover on today's show before, privately and publicly, and that is literature, film, and the faith, looking for the Catholic faith and Christian symbolism, Christian meaning, transcendent meaning in films, not just in overtly religious films, but places we might not think we would find it, you know, and always looking for that. So I thought, Father Stan, a good place to start might be with just introducing you to our listeners. I know you've been on Holy Family Radio before for the Share-a-thons, and many of them might know you already from your work at Aquinas. But maybe tell us how your background and how you got interested in this particular topic, of course, but a little bit of background before you came to Aquinas.
Well, it's a long background since I'm 62 years old. But I have been a Dominican for 39 years, a priest for 34 years. I am a cradle Catholic, but like most people, struggled with coming to understand my faith in a mature way as I was growing up. And growing up in the late 60s, maturing in the late 60s, early 70s, it was a challenging time culturally. It was very difficult finding values and Christian meaning that were being expressed at that point in time. But I figured they had to be here somewhere. I first started becoming extremely interested in what I call interdisciplinary studies when I was in high school. And as a junior, they did an experimental course in my public high school called American Ideas and Issues. Junior year, you get your American history, you get your American civics, you get your American literature. But this was one course that covered everything. We read American philosophy, literature, history, all in conjunction with each other so that we would have the experience of the integration of it, that nothing exists in a vacuum. And that has significantly defined me and my studies ever since.
That must have been a great class.
It was a phenomenal class with three terrific teachers.
So what disciplines did the teachers come from? Do you remember then? So it was a team-taught course.
One was in English, one was in social studies, and one was in history.
Oh, that sounds great.
It was. Yeah. It was. But the historian was a closet philosopher.
Yeah, well, some of us are, some of us aren't. I'm not saying.
But remember, this was in the late 60s, so he had us reading Ayn Rand.
Okay.
But it was when I was in college that I started to develop a real love of learning. And the religious component hit me like a board upside the head when I took a course in the English department that was taught by a Dominican sister. Now, a sister in 1972 teaching in a state university in this country was, at the best I could, I've always thought of it as missionary work. Mm-hmm. And she was known. She never tried in any way to hide her religious affiliation or her commitment as a sister. She was a great scholar and a terrific teacher. And from her, I learned the melding of the religious sensibilities with what would be normally considered secular studies. And that was where I learned that God is readable anywhere. Authors may not intend and may object to things being read into their writings. But once they write it, it's no longer theirs. Remember that with your writing.
Well, I'm going over my page proof even now, trying to remember that.
But there's always, for an artist of whatever medium, something that's revealed about them that they may not intend, but it's there. And once they decide to make it public, it's our task to discover.
So, and you're, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're not talking about a postmodern approach of interpretation where I as the reader can infuse it with meaning. You're implying there's a real action of God somewhere in there because these are human creatures doing the writing and the producing, or the sub-creating, as J.R.R. Tolkien liked to call the art. And so there's something of God in there, whether they want it there or not.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. No, postmodern and Stan Drungowski have never been uttered in the same sentence.
Until now. These are the kinds of things we do on Faith and Reason.
That's right.
Amazing
this is,
show.
This is an exciting moment to be here.
Well, why don't we start with let's just talk about your favorite film, and then we'll go from there. Can we do that? Can we just move right into
absolutely?
Maybe. Well, no. Let's your favorite film, or maybe it's a movie where you think most of our listeners they would say, "Yeah, I don't see that." You know, the popes have talked about Babette's Feast, of course, and I know that's one of your favorite films. But maybe there's another movie that our listeners would be familiar with or not so familiar with, and it's the kind of movie they say, "Wow, I really didn't see that before," because there's that. The things our instructors and professors and chaplains, the great help we try to provide is to make people see the same old things in new ways. And it is true that there are works of art and literature and film where you kind of do need a guide.
Right.
Or at least to show you that there's more to it than you thought once you get past the entertainment level.
Or to develop the tools that are necessary in order for a critical viewing or a critical reading.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one movie that comes to my mind, actually it keeps coming to my mind, and it has ever since I saw it, was the movie Inception. Huh. It was popular about 4 years ago, I think.
I don't think I've seen Inception, so you'll have to tell me.
That's okay. Well, I have a copy, so I'll lend it to
okay.
you if you promise to give it back.
Oh, sure. Sure.
In it, it's like a science fantasy type of movie, but it goes into the dimensionality of the psyche and the ability. The point where disbelief has to be suspended is that it's possible to enter into different persons' levels of consciousness.
Okay.
And this is something that is possible, but only by God. And so, as in so many cases, there's a God figure in the movie. But the difficulty is that he's flawed. And you've seen that in literature and art for millennia, the flawed hero. But you see this person seeking to do good and seeking to bring good about, contrary to all of the actions of so many other players, and to bring about, in a sense, conversion. Bring about the conversion moment in the people that need conversion. And it's a fascinating, fascinating study. And great music.
And great music. I'll put it in the queue, as they say, or I'll borrow your copy. And that was not the intention of the movie?
I think the movie was probably intended as a science fiction entertainment.
Serious science fiction. You know, I was watching a program fairly recently on the science fiction author Robert Heinlein,
mm-hmm.
who wrote many years ago. And part of the program I was watching was talking about controversy over his alleged flirtation with fascism and certain arguments about the state and its power over people and citizenship and who ought to be a citizen. Speaking of Ayn Rand, the productive and the unproductive and that kind of thing, I think. But it made me think about science fiction in a way that I didn't as a young person, but I did later in all sorts of ways, and that is there's so many ways through science fiction and fiction generally where we can visit, what would the world look like if we took some of these philosophical ideas and just put them full bore into work? You know, what we have, whether it's 1984 or Huxley's Brave New World, which is maybe more approaching our current reality, I think, than other novels.
Than we want to think about.
And so when you mention it's meant to be science fiction and entertainment, the best science fiction, in my opinion, has been the kind that's really a comment on our world and not simply escapist, not simply genre fiction.
Yes.
And so it sounds like that would fit in that category.
Yes, and yes. Maybe, I think another great example is Fahrenheit 451.
Oh, sure. That's one of the – Ray Bradbury.
Yeah.
He's another fascinating figure for sure. I know he was a good friend of Michigan's Man of Letters, Russell Kirk, another author I've written or read quite a bit of. And I remember reading that in high school, and I recall only getting out of it that censorship is bad. It wasn't until reading it later as an adult you get to many of the other messages, and it's very the very important message about learning and book learning and custom and passing things down. And there's just so many there's so much to that that movie. And I remember what was the other Ray Bradbury, The Martian Chronicles, this miniseries on television, which I thought had much less to say than Fahrenheit 451, as I recall.
But, bring up a point, though, John, that I think is really important, the greater works. And I'm not going to say by any stretch of the imagination that all film, literature, whatever, is on the equal plane.
Sure. I'm glad to hear you. Well, if we don't utter Father Dungowski and postmodern in the same sentence, that would be true. No, I separate genre fiction from classics and from great works,
right?
And I think it takes time as the great divider on those things.
It is, and the time is a lifetime. If an individual can go back to something that they saw or read as a teenager and experience it 20 years later and find more in it, chances are that's a great piece.
And the other thing I would add then is if I can read something written several hundred years ago and still find something in it, there is something in it.
It speaks to the fundamental human condition.
Yeah, which doesn't change.
Exactly.
I tell my students that all the time about Cicero. There's a reason. He sounds like he could be writing about your society or you or your problems or issues, and it's because he's human. He was writing to other humans, and human nature does not change regardless of what some might try to argue.
And it's humbling to come to that realization. Mm-hmm. It's very humbling. I did my master's thesis on Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. And some would think of that as a 14th century entertainment that was perhaps recited at the king's table or something like that. But it's an extremely significant spiritual work that I discovered as I was researching it. And I think that's another example.
Could you elaborate on that? I hope many of our listeners have probably read that. I know I read that for the first time in high school, and then when I learned that Tolkien was one of the translators,
yes,
Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, I reread it again with different eyes. Mm-hmm. And can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Oh my goodness, that was 35 years ago that I wrote that thesis.
Okay,
I'm surprised I remember the subject, but It's basically the spiritual quest of Gawain. It is his experience as a Knight of the Round Table, as the nephew of King Arthur, of going on this quest of trust in the inner power that God has given him. That's okay. It in a nutshell.
Okay.
And failing the first two times. But as in so much literature, you have your third time's the charm. Your triads are important to look at.
Okay. Yeah. Well, failure's part of the story.
That's
isn't
right.
The worst kinds of novels like that, or stories or films even, are the overly morally didactic novels where the hero is always a hero, makes no mistakes, so he has no mistakes to learn from. And it's difficult to learn. It's difficult to learn from that. It's like when we discover saints who seem human and not to have been born saintly from day one, and we learn about their conversion experience. And I recall hearing Mother Angelica say once, that there was a special place in purgatory reserved for those who write the biographies of saints. And I think she was just implying, you know, give us all a break. Show us every side so that we can, so the holiness will stand out all the more. I guess that was her point.
And I think that is a vital point, that it's in the struggle that we find our own openness to the salvation that's been won for us.
So Aristotle said that every good story is supposed to teach a moral. Would you agree with that?
Even bad stories teach a moral.
But
it could be the wrong moral. But even a poorly written work, I'm thinking I can enjoy a movie like Shrek. Shrek is fun. It's great fun. But it's not something that I'm going to go back and watch over and over and over again. Because it's pretty much a one-note amusement.
Oh, it's entertainment.
Yeah.
Nothing more.
But I will go back and rewatch A Lion in Winter, which is, coming on 45 years old.
Who starred in that?
Catherine Hepburn and Peter O'Toole. It was his second performance as Henry II.
Was it really?
Yeah.
Okay. So what is it about Lion in Winter? What do you see in that? I had that movie for many years before I watched it. I inherited a movie collection from my uncle, and it was a long time. I don't know why. I just somehow it was always put it off. But he had a great collection of movies from that time period.
But I think on the superficial level, visually, it's magnificent. Mm-hmm. The acting is incomparable. It won the best picture, I think it was in 69, for good reason. But the human struggle with passion, human struggle with power, interrelationship, you might say it's the story of a dysfunctional family, and it certainly is. Yet at the same time, they're able to come to terms with their flaws and to come to an acceptance of each other.
I wonder if we could move into looking at some more overtly religious movies.
Okay.
At least those that are metaphorical, like Babette's Feast, which seems to be a favorite. If I know an Orthodox friend of mine, it's his favorite movie. I don't recall whether it was Pope Benedict or Pope Francis who listed it as, I think it was Pope Francis
was
in one
Francis.
Of his interviews who listed among his favorites. And, I saw it once and I thought it once. And I thought, well, it's good. And I get the Eucharistic imagery, but I've always wondered how to go deeper into it.
Unfortunate thing is I feel that so many people who have seen the movie Babette's Feast have not read the novella.
Is that the problem? Because I have not read it.
Because actually, the movie is better than the novella.
Really?
It is so often not the case.
Right.
I think that Isaac Dinesen wrote it as a trifle. But it was the filmmaker who took it, and it's the power of adding the visual and, in a sense, taking the opportunity to expand the meaning of it, the meaning of community, the meaning of incarnation. To look at Babette's Feast as strictly Eucharistic because you have the banquet would be to cut it short. You have to look at the whole movie,
mm-hmm.
and you have to see how Babette is influenced by the two sisters, Martine and Philippa, and how they are influenced by her. The whole community is influenced by Babette. You can see that in the scene where, after several years, Babette goes off and the sisters start taking the food that they have prepared to the shut-ins of the town. And you realize that they have become accustomed to the food as Babette cooked it. And it's all shown by the look, an expression on a face. So this is an example of how the incarnational was, I felt, depicted in the film. And the power of, when you then look at the power of the incarnation of Christ, and all of these are just simple renderings when you look at what Christ has done for us. But they're powerful reminders as well that we can be incarnational for each other. The influence, John, that you can have in my life, even though we've only known each other for a few months, is potentially profound, and I'm looking forward to it.
I as well.
No pressure there. Yeah.
Oh, sure. I'll get right on that. likewise, I have to say it's Father Stan, it's great having you at Aquinas, and I know in talking with you before you accepted the chaplain position, we talked about some of these ideas in Catholic studies and some of the things we do in there, which is largely, you know, it's interdisciplinary. And it's a look at art and literature primarily, and speaking through beauty or finding beauty in places where you might not expect it, or edifying ideas and transcendence in places you might not expect it. I don't know that we've yet done a film class.
And also identifying sin and naming it as such.
Let's talk about that. I knew a philosopher, a friend of mine, Mark Moas, who teaches at Grand Valley State, and he was... We were talking about film noirs one time, and he called them studies in original sin.
Ooh.
I recall that being his phrase. And, you know, ever since then, I've looked at them quite differently. Prior to that, I thought, well, why do I want to watch somebody's life fall apart on the screen? Life is depressing enough without watching other people's depressing lives on television. Why do I want to go through that as well? But just that simple statement, if you talk about having a profound impact on somebody else simply by saying something, I thought, well, now that's a different way to look at it then, because I'm watching the unfolding consequences of sin, and it's got so many tentacles in important ways and less important ways just from one bad decision at the beginning of one of these movies. I'm thinking of this, is it A Perfect Stranger? I can't remember the title. It's an Edward G. Robinson film noir where I don't want to spoil the ending, although how could I, because I can't remember the title. But it's largely a dream sequence movie. But he makes a bad decision in the beginning, and everything goes off the rails. Mm-hmm. Marriage, his life, he's wanted by the police, murder, just mayhem. Everything results just from one sin. And I thought, well, that is a study in original sin, then isn't it?
It is. It is. But there was also always the possibility, even though in that particular piece it didn't happen, mm-hmm. of turning that tragedy.
Well, it may have. I didn't want to ruin the ending.
Oh. There is always the possibility of turning a tragedy into comedy. The difference between tragedy and comedy is that in the tragedy, you have your initial action that sets off this chain of events that drives everything toward an ultimate disaster. And it's completed. Comedy is an event that sets everything off on a stream toward disaster, but something happens to turn it off course to save from disaster.
So this is why Dante wrote the Divine Comedy and not the Divine Tragedy.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. I think a classic example of this in popular culture was the television show some years back, Cheers, set in a bar in Boston. It was populated by a has-been relief pitcher from the Boston Red Sox who was a recovering alcoholic, a failed academician, a woman who has had repeated marriages, and another, a man who has a serious drinking problem, unresolved, and a questionable marriage, another guy who lives with his mother, and he's in his 40s as a postal carrier. Excuse me. But what keeps any of them from becoming a tragic figure is each other.
That's a good way to look at that program, especially after your description of the characters, which is exactly true.
Yeah, it's a great story of what church should be, what the Christian community should be, taking one another with our flaws and saving each other from doing stupid things.
Mm-hmm. So we're all broken people
yeah.
in the pew. We're not perfect people.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
I recall the spinoff from that show, Frasier.
Oh, yeah.
One of my favorite programs.
Mine, too.
And, I mean, there's all sorts of reasons it's my favorite program, not least because I can become discombobulated like Frasier, I think, sometimes, but there was a lot to that program, too. I found it one of the most introspective programs on television for mm-hmm. the last few decades compared to others. Now, I really don't watch any television now. I couldn't comment on any new TV shows. But I do watch quite a few films, and I'm thinking about this. So in mentioning the film noir, I wonder if in that genre, if you had one or two that you might recommend that could demonstrate what we're talking about to our listeners.
I think a great one, and I don't know that it would be described as noir,
okay.
but Hitchcock's Rebecca. That was another movie of that great year, 1939.
And Hitchcock was Catholic.
Mm-hmm. But Joan Fontaine and... Laurence Olivier. It was a wonderful, visually and thematically dark movie. And it was terrifying in its own way. But the twist at the end that brought light into the scene was breathtaking. If you haven't seen that,
I have not seen Rebecca.
It is well worth.
And I love Hitchcock's films. The last one I watched was, I confess, was a Hitchcock
yes.
film, wasn't it?
Yes, with Montgomery Clift.
Yes, that was amazing. Someone had recommended it to me, and I had never seen it before.
Mm-hmm.
And just tremendously Catholic movie in so many in so many ways, and not just because it involves a priest and the sacrament of confession, but just the idea of confessing and the idea of various broken people, you know, at different levels of different levels of suffering, and not knowing who has done what to whom, and there's all kind. I mean, there's just so many levels to that movie. That was a fantastic.
It was. It's a great, great film. And not only because it focuses rather overtly on one of my favorite sacraments, as a presider of the sacrament, but the power of the commitment and his willingness to live in his commitment.
I'm thinking Catholic Studies ought to have a Hitchcock film festival, perhaps.
Awesome, yes.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea, is it?
Yeah, because that one film I mentioned to you earlier, Strangers in the Train, is also Hitchcock.
What is it? What is it you think is so distinctive about the Catholic imagination? And you know, I wouldn't call Hitchcock's not going to be up for canonization anytime soon. Neither is Martin Scorsese. But these are two
or Coppola.
These are three now. You know, very Catholic filmmakers in terms of their imagination, and I don't think that's a coincidence. Somehow that sacramental imagination,
that's
as it's
exactly
been called. I mean, there it is in all their films, and yet, I'd rather have you.
I think it's exactly what you say: the sacramental imagination, the reality of grace, the reality of sin, the reality that flawed people can be saved, or can be damned. The personal responsibility, the communal responsibility, these are all very Catholic themes. That doesn't mean that other religious sensibilities don't tap into it, but most of them do not have that sacramental depth and that development of the spirituality and grace.
I think that's true. I teach a class at Aquinas called Christian View of History, but it was once called Perspectives on Christian Culture, and we did a lot with the Catholic imagination. One of the last books I had the students read, which I no longer assign for the course, it's a bit of a different course now, was a book by Andrew Greeley called The Catholic Imagination. He talks a lot about Scorsese in there and Mean Streets and some particular movies, but the point he made was he described the Catholic imagination and its distinctiveness, and then the Protestant imagination as well.
Mm-hmm.
He pulled back from saying one was better in the sense of being more fully human.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Catholic imagination is, because it does take into account the physicalness and the analogies we find in creation in a way that the Protestant imagination typically does not. It's interesting to hear you say that about those films as well. I mean, I found myself agreeing with Greeley, and I can't say I'd ever read anything else by him, and I have no interest in his novels. But that particular book, I had a student who has since gone on to a religious order, and she really did not want to read Father Greeley. She was sure she wouldn't find much there. I said, well, read this book. It's different than what you may have heard about anything else you've heard about Greeley. And it was, you know, it's really an excellent little book. I'd recommend it, The Catholic Imagination, as an introduction.
Mm-hmm.
Our listeners might also be interested in reading some of the works of Joseph Pierce and others on just these distinctive hallmarks of the Catholic imagination.
Mm-hmm. Andrew Greeley did some great sociological work. That's his area.
Mm-hmm.
He was a sociologist.
And a novelist on the side.
Novelist.
I've yet to write the great American novel. I'll put that. That's far down my list. But have you ever taken a crack at your own fiction?
I haven't. I have been tempted to try some short stories. I love the short story genre. Mm. The
And you think you could I guess you'd have to try it to find out whether
it was. I'd have to try it, yeah.
I remember one time, only once, I tried to make my own beer, and it was then that I realized that there's some really pleasant, amazing things in life that I would rather leave to mm-hmm. to experts and craftsmen, and I'd rather buy well-made beer from somebody else rather than drink my own, which was not that tasty.
Well, one of the things I have to say from my personal experience is that as an undergraduate, I studied art, and my goal at that point was to become an art teacher in general and an art therapist in particular. But what I found in taking the studio classes is that a certain kind of narcissism started to develop in myself that I didn't recognize and I didn't like. I no longer felt like myself. And you have to really, as an artist of any form, really be willing to battle that particular demon.
Why are artists so susceptible to narcissism?
Because art is an extremely personal thing. And it was Voltaire who, I believe, said, God created man in his own image, and man has returned the compliment. And if he didn't say it, he should have. And the artist tends, by necessity, as they're creating this world, of becoming godlike. And I think that's the great human temptation. Mm-hmm. Back to the Genesis creation account. To want to be God. And when you start to believe your own press in that regard, you're playing with fire. And I myself have found other outlets. And just want to let God do his job.
Sure. Well, when you think about that being created in the image of God, then that means we're created as creatures who would also want to create.
That's why we have the sacrament of matrimony, for one thing.
Well, but procreate as well.
But in other aspects, that's exactly mm-hmm. right. Procreation can also analogously be the production of art. But I think the Native Americans have it right when in every item they produce, they include a flaw. Because God is the only one who can create something.
So there's an intentional flaw.
Intentional flaw. To remind themselves that they are not God.
And isn't it the Buddhists? There's groups of Buddhists who make these sand designs.
Yes.
Painstakingly.
Yes.
And then, as soon as they're done, admire it for a moment and just wipe
destroy it off and
destroy it to show how things like that pass. We've touched around literature so far. Why don't we get into literature for a bit?
Okay.
As you know, one of the courses in the core of Catholic Studies is our Catholic Writers class at Aquinas. And the students, speaking of short stories, do read Flannery O'Connor. Mm-hmm. Thought by many, and maybe you, to be the best Catholic short story writer, and one of the best just short story writers of the 20th century.
I would agree with that.
I know with theologians who don't like O'Connor, too dark or something, and then I know some who really appreciate her. I wonder if we might talk about Flannery O'Connor for a bit. The students, it's almost always the students' first introduction mm-hmm. to Flannery O'Connor. And it's a great way to be introduced to her in a class on Catholic writers where they're thinking about the Catholic imagination and relating it to that and not just simply seeing her as a Southern writer or mm-hmm. a female writer, but as a Catholic writer in a larger sense. Mm-hmm. What would you want to tell us about O'Connor?
Well, I would say, first of all, her I wouldn't even pigeonhole her in any way other than saying she's a great writer.
And I think she would probably have agreed with you.
And
but this is the person who read from the Summa every night as a devotion.
Yeah.
Which I remember trying to do that, and it didn't work for me. But there's still time, I guess. But I've tried that.
But as a bedtime reading, it probably did its job.
Well, it may have done that.
I would say O'Connor's. I get what I have gotten most out of O'Connor is the relationship of redemption going from sin to grace. That one of my favorite ones, and it's just absolutely charming, is The Temple of the Holy Ghost. Mm. One of her short stories, and it's just a homely little story, but it is so human. And it touches on the profundity of what might be conceived as a homely little pious thought, but the reality of who we are with the Holy Spirit dwelling within us.
The last one I remember reading was the famous A Good Man is Hard to Find, mm-hmm. And that collection. And I find that I can read through O'Connor's stories in one sitting, and that, I come away thinking about the depth of humanity and wondering how this sickly woman who spent a lot of time with her, what kind of birds did she have on her farm there? Was it peacocks?
They were peacocks, yeah.
Yeah, peacocks. Spent a lot of time with her peacocks and a lot of letter writing, just how she could produce such deeply wise literature. It continues to fascinate me.
I just, before coming here, received in the mail a copy of her prayers. They just recently discovered her prayer journal.
Who published those?
I didn't even open the package. I was just so excited because I had to get over here for this recording. But I'll let you know.
Okay, sure. Yeah, so Flannery O'Connor's prayers have been published. I've read through her letters, and I'm a letter reader. I love the letters of her letters, other people's letters. It's just amazing. Just some fascinating stuff. And I would encourage our listeners, even if you haven't read O'Connor's fiction, to look through those letters if you want to see a good Catholic mind at work in the mid-20th century. Just very, very impressive and wise for such I think she died. She was still in her 30s.
Yes.
So she died very, very young. So there's a lot of wisdom, I think, in those letters. And food for thought, I would say.
In a sense, she is to American Catholic letters in the 20th century what Emily Dickinson was for American poetry in the 18th century or the 19th century.
Was O'Connor that unknown during her lifetime?
I don't think she was very widely known or read. But I think that she was. The reason I say that, the comparison that I draw, is someone who lived a rather sheltered life, mm-hmm. yet being able to articulate such profound depth and wisdom. Part of it is her broad reading and insane curiosity.
I think it certainly doesn't take years and years of academic training to make a good novelist, does it?
No.
I recall C.S. Lewis once responded to a question put to him when someone asked, "You've never had children. Who do you think you are to write children's novels and children's books? You yourself have never had children. What do you know?" And his response was, "But I was one."
And that's true.
That was his response. And so let's... It looks like we have 10 minutes left here. Okay. They're telling me on the other side of the studio. I did want to talk about the Brothers Karamazov because it's a popular book among some of our Catholic students.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly is. I know it's Dr. Marshall's favorite novel, I think, in our theology department, and I've read through it a couple times. And what is it that people keep coming back to in the Brothers K, as the students call it, in the Brothers K? What is it that people keep coming back to, particularly Catholics coming back to that novel written by an Orthodox writer?
Actually, a marginally Orthodox writer. Not exactly probably the most fervent believer.
True enough, yeah.
But I think it is, and it's like his Crime and Punishment as well. It's an intense look at the depth of the human soul. I think Dostoevsky has been able to plumb that depth. And not only to plumb it, but to mine it for us. He's able to describe in, I think, absolutely brilliant terms, and I unfortunately can only read it in translation. It's the kind of thing that you really would almost want to be able to read.
Oh, I think it's always my lament with Dostoevsky's works. That's my lament with the Aeneid. I mean, that's the Divine Comedy for that matter. It's much more of a concern when it comes to poetry. But
yes.
It's amazing, even in the English translation, how beautiful the prose is, and in a translation. That's it's always impressed me.
That the art of the translator is a great one.
Mm-hmm.
But back to the Dostoevsky, it's that rubbing together of it's not just plumbing a soul, it's plumbing souls and how on different levels they connect or disconnect. The relation of the brothers to each other, that looming presence of the Father.
Mm-hmm.
The ambivalent feelings toward the Father. All of this combines to one of the greatest masterpieces in world literature.
Yeah, and again, here we have, in this case, a marginally Russian Orthodox man,
mm-hmm.
who nevertheless produces something so insightful about human nature and about sin and redemption.
Well, look at Mozart's music.
Another another example for sure. In our last few minutes here, I'd like to let you talk about whatever film or novel you think our listeners that ought to read, should like to read. Maybe you have a list of a few that you can send out there, give folks a reading list or a viewing list.
I'd like to mention three. Gabriel Garcia Marquez, 100 Years of Solitude. It is probably the classic example of Latin American phenomenalism. It's bizarre. It's hysterically funny. It's highly spiritual and very readable. If you're looking for something that is not only a love story and a mystery novel and an historical fiction, that's also a great piece of literature, Orhan Pamuk's My Name is Red is a great place to start. He won the Nobel Prize for Literature, I believe, maybe sometime in the 90s, 89. I can't remember. But my name is Red, as well as his Snow and White are three great novels that he's written. Finally, my personal, the one that I keep going back to at various points in my life, that is one of the great correctives for me, is Madame Bovary, Flaubert. It's on the surface, the story of a woman who's just in a tragic downward cycle. Spiral is the better way of putting it. But for me, it's the reminder of what happens if we don't live in truth. Each of us is called to live in truth. God has given us our truth. He's placed us where we are. He's given us who we are. He has given us a context. And when we choose to deny who we are, when we choose to deny our truth, we are going to ultimately find ourselves doomed. But fulfillment and happiness will only happen if we live in our truth.
Conforming
ourselves to God's will, as opposed to trying to create our own.
Yeah. And that is the original sin, isn't it?
Exactly.
We were talking about the unfolding and unpredictable consequences of sin earlier. This is Dr. John Pinheiro. I've been talking with Father Stan Drungowski, the Dominican and chaplain of Aquinas College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. We've been talking for just about the last hour on films, novels, short stories, and how to look for Christian meaning and values in those stories, even when sometimes the artists themselves don't intend it, or especially when they do, those things maybe they're more deeply than we otherwise might think. I like to, on one, we'll do a tiny controversial note at the end and just ask you to pick one overtly religious movie that you wouldn't recommend, that you think this is too over the top, hit you on the head with it too much, too morally didactic. The Song of Bernadette. Oh, you picked a lot of people love that movie.
I know, and it is a favorite, but I keep expecting Bernadette to walk on the air.
It's just too much.
And Linda Darnell is the Blessed Mother. I'm sorry, I just can't swallow that one.
Well, on that note, we're done here with Faith and Reason. Thank you for listening. Hope you tune in next Friday. Thank you for coming, Father Stan.
John, it's been a delight.
Okay, good afternoon.
Look forward to seeing you in the Moose.
You've been listening to Faith and Reason with your host, Dr. John Pinheiro, on Holy Family Radio. If you'd like to listen to this program again or share it with a friend, audio copies are available online at holyfamilyradio.net. Dr. John Pinheiro is Associate Professor of History and Director of Catholic Studies at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Faith and Reason is brought to you by Holy Family Radio. I'm your program producer, Michael Fiorenzo. Join us next time as we connect the riches of the Catholic intellectual tradition to daily life. Thanks for listening.